This morning's talk, let me explain why I'm here. I've been a Unitarian Universalist for less than 2 years. Yeah. And yet, I feel like I've been part of this group for decades. We found the Unitarian Universalist Church of Spartanburg. I started by going to Greenville and found that Spartanburg was closer to our house and it worked so well for us. But my wife and I used to walk during lunchtime when we both worked in libraries, and we would pass the Unitarian Church and say, "Our professors go there. It would be so nice to go there someday." And I don't know why we didn't, but we are here now. And I talked to people at our church about my perceptions now as being a UU, and there are some things that, quite frankly, bothered me, and I brought that up at some of our meetings. I noticed when I told people that I was a UU that often after I told them, their eyes dropped. That was the experience I felt. Okay. And in South Carolina, it's interesting. So many people come up to you and say, "Hello, I'm so-and-so, and what church do you belong to?" I even had someone come up and say, "And what Baptist church do you belong to?" So, well, I did notice the eyes dropping, and it bothered me. And so I'm undertaking a task in my own life to better learn how to respond to people about my religion. Today I'm talking about not what to respond, but how to respond. I would not, far be it from me to tell you how to tell you what to respond, but I want to tell you the stylistic ways of how to respond. And I'm going to talk about myself a little bit, and my congregation would roll their eyes. I'm talking about schools because that's what I was affiliated with all my career. My teaching career started in the 70s, and I recall going for that first interview in a public school to teach high school English. And I sat in front of the superintendent, and he said, "Now you realize this job means that you'll be coaching football, coaching basketball, directing two plays, directing the countywide spelling bee, advising the school newspaper, and teaching six classes with four preparations." And I thought about my wife, who was with child at that time, and I thought about our bank account. And did you ever sit and just try to justify? I'm sitting there justifying. Well, that doesn't sound too bad. Coaching football. Well, I was in the band. Well, I signed the contract, and I got the job. And I marched over to the public library and checked out a book on how to coach football in high schools. And, of course, it was very difficult. The one problem occurred in 2 days when one of my players, Tim Johnson, came up and he said, hey, coach. "We're going to play the power eye. We're going to do the power eye this year. I want to do the power eye." And I said, "Johnson, I got to get to chapter 6 of this book. I'm an English major. We're going to do all the power of vowels." Well, speech class was interesting because in the academics, I learned quite a bit there, and I learned how to respond in that class. That is the class that best taught me how to respond to others. I had a great idea. I wanted to teach these high school students that a good audience, like you folks are, is very important to the speaker. So I had two young girls who were giving a talk, and they worked very hard and they planned. And I had the first girl go into the classroom, and beforehand, they were in a class across the hall, I said to the audience, okay, I want you to be on the very edge of your seats. I want you asking questions. I want you to smile. I want you to be a really great audience. And they were. And the speech was a great success. And I thought, boy, this assignment that I'm thinking of is just so good. I'm such a good teacher. Now I change the rules. Before the next young girl came in, I asked the people to do things like talk and play a game. And one person was sleeping, and it was like the Muppet Show out there. Everybody was doing things. And this young girl came in, and she stood up, and she started giving her talk. And then she stopped. And then she started giving her talk again, and then the tears came. And I realized at that point, and I'm probably responsible for a lot of therapy in this young girl's life. And I worked with her, actually, I worked with her throughout the whole term, and I never got her back after that. But I did not know enough about teaching to empathize with students. I was interested in my own response, but I was not interested in the student's response. So I left the student out. I showed no empathy, and empathy is the action of understanding, being aware of, being sensitive to, and vicariously experiencing the feelings of another person. And I didn't have that at all. And I had to work to get that. Once I found that, I felt that I became a good teacher. I'd like to read just a very short paragraph that I got from the Atlantic Monthly. I still call it the Atlantic Monthly. The Atlantic Magazine recently about a politician, Shirley Chisholm. And listen to the empathy in this. Shirley Chisholm, the first African-American woman elected to Congress, launched a bid for the presidency in 1972. In May of that year, she took a step that baffled supporters. After a would-be assassin shot George Wallace at point-blank range during a campaign appearance in Laurel, Maryland, Chisholm visited Wallace in the hospital to express her concern and sympathy. The gesture attracted widespread media attention and puzzled, to say the least, those who had followed Wallace's career as one of the most vitriolic segregationists of his day. Chisholm wanted to convey, in part, her belief that it was important in a democracy to respect contrary opinions without, quote, impugning the motives and maligning the character of one's opponents. To view it any other way, Chisholm argued, was to encourage the same sickness in public life that leads to assassinations. All Chisholm did was empathize with Wallace and take him into her deepest concerns. We all remember the families of murdered victims at Charleston AME Church and how that whole congregation responded to the shooter. They responded with forgiveness. And we remember President Obama's response when he went down to Charleston, singing Amazing Grace. Responses matter, and a big hint is that empathy has a lot to do with it. Did you ever consider what your daily responses sound like? Do I look like an encyclopedia to you? Yeah, you too, buddy. And where'd you get your license from? A Cracker Jack box? Can't you see I'm busy? Come on, pal, any day now, any day now. That's not going to get any greener. I'm sure that little sign up there saying 10 items or less doesn't really apply to you, ma'am. Yeah, it's a bit simplistic, but our children learn to respond because they're watching. My father was a very proud Englishman, and I, to this day, always remember the way he acted in a car when something happened, his responses. That's the part, and that's not the part I want to remember about my father. Consider road etiquette. Consider television talk shows. Everyone is yelling and nobody seems to be listening. Just on Friday, Pope Francis said, insulting has become normal. Wars start inside our hearts when I'm not able to open myself to others, to respect others, to dialogue with others. This is how wars begin. Think about yourself. How did you learn to respond? Is it the style that you're hearing today on talk shows, on road etiquette, on tweeting? Is that what we're listening to? In school, we ask students to respond. And you can picture those little elementary schools. If you've ever walked into a class, and the teacher asks the questions, and the students are falling out of the chair trying to answer the question. And then you get into junior high, and In high school, I've been there. I'm not sure I want to do that. For me, college was a time when my responses began to take shape. I learned from what they call in the English department hack writers, but they're syndicated columnists. I learned from people like Art Buchwald and Mike Royko and Ellen Goodman and Jim Bishop, and I'll bet some of you know these names. So many of the people who were writing editorials in the newspaper. That's where I got my ideas on how to respond. But I had a favorite, and my favorite was Sidney J. Harris. Sidney Harris. He had a column called Strictly Speaking, or Strictly Personal. And I read that column religiously. Every day I read that column. He was a good writer. As a matter of fact, his style of writing, I even taught in a composition class. He has had a book out called Pieces of Eight, and he wrote in an eight-paragraph style, so unlike what is taught in colleges today. But he always made a personal connection with his audience, and his writing is timeless. Even 30 years old now, I'd like to share with you just a couple of points that he made. One is what I wish I would have known at 18, that a free offer is usually the most expensive kind. That a person is not judged by what he knows, but how he, she wears it. That when a person's position in life depends upon his or her having a certain opinion, that is the opinion he or she will have. That the worst sins are committed by indifference, not by vice. That the people who are suspicious of certain things are the very ones who are the most capable of doing that of which they are suspicious. That the atheist who believes in man and scorns God can be closer to holiness than the religionist who believes in God and scorns man. Sidney Harris had a short essay in which he talked about responding, and it really applies to what we're discussing today. It's called Keep Control of Your Personality. He talks about the time that he was leaving his apartment house with a Quaker friend, and they stopped to pick up a newspaper along the way. And the Quaker friend stops, he gets his newspaper, he talks to the newsie, to the newsstand fellow, and he says, "Hello, how are you today?" And the man just grumbles and just makes, you know, some very crude comments. And the Quaker says, "Thank you very much," and walks to Sidney Harris. And Harris says, "Boy, that was a sullen fellow." And the Quaker retorted, "Well, he's that way every morning." And Harris said, "Well, why do you continue to be so polite to him?" And the Quaker responded, "Why not? Why should I let him decide how I'm going to act?" The Quaker just refused to return incivility with incivility. Harris quickly learned the lesson that allowing another individual to determine whether you should be rude or gracious, elated or depressed, is to relinquish control over our own personalities. Think about Michelle Obama saying, "When they go low, you go high," a saying I've heard. Someone needs to be the adult in the room. Integrity comes from being who you are, as Parker Palmer said. Now, here I am, a Unitarian Universalist, and my family, my extended family, and my sons are asking me questions. I found that some people are saying, "Is this a cult? And what is this with social justice?" I started off by saying, okay, you realize that the early presidents were Unitarian. I talk about the Transcendentalists, Henry David Thoreau and Ralph Waldo Emerson, Bronson Alcott and Margaret Fuller. But that doesn't help. I could explain Thomas Jefferson's ideas when he worked to publish his own Bible. And I try to explain that ours is more of a cerebral spirituality, and I've never had that before. In my career, I've taught Martin Luther King's letter from Birmingham jail, and I've taught Henry David Thoreau's civil disobedience, but I've never really walked in their shoes until now. I was invited by Sally Beth. Some of you might remember Sally Beth, our minister down in Spartanburg. She was getting a group together, and she knew how I felt about the gun show loophole and waiting period for gun ownership. So she invited me to Columbia to march. And it's the first time I've ever done anything like that in long, ever. I've got a lot of the Midwest in me, and I am the type to just pick up and do things, and I haven't learned to socialize very much. And that was, again, a little bit of that empathy we're talking about. So when I went to Columbia, we were marching for the gun control. And at the very end of the day, a woman came up with our group. We had a pretty good substantial group, and we were getting our picture taken, and she wanted to be part of that group until she realized that we were part of a church. And then she wanted to know a little bit about it. I have to give Sally Beth credit. Our minister stood there and talked to this woman for 15 minutes. We were in the hot sun waiting to get our picture taken, and Sally Beth was talking, explaining. This woman didn't want to have her picture taken with us after that. It was kind of sad, but she took the picture. Symbolically, I think that's interesting. But she did take the picture, and she was with us in spirit for what we were doing. But I learned a lot from Sally Beth from just that experience. So I have to ask you, were you ever surprised by a response from someone? And I'm sure you've been somewhere along the line. Sometimes you've been disappointed by a friend's response, someone you thought you knew pretty well. And none of us can be ready for every situation. But Sidney Harris once again has an essay called "Hate is Rarely a Personal Matter." And this was a time when someone went up to Harris, a very close friend, and said, "I really need your help." And I'm sure many of you have been in that circumstance with a son or a daughter, with a good friend. They're relying upon you, and you have to sum up all your willpower, all of your empathy, and understand the predicament and give some good counsel. This friend said, you know, I can't understand it, but this person hates me. I cannot understand why this person hates me, but this person hates me. What do I do? And Harris could tell this fellow was just forlorn. Harris said, usually if we dislike someone, it is the shadow of the person that is disliked, not the substance. We may dislike someone because he or she reminds us of someone we feared or disliked when younger, or because we see in him or her some gross caricature, or because he or she symbolizes an attitude that seems to threaten us. Pretty remarkable way of thinking about it. How many of us would give that pat answer, "Oh, you'll be okay"? My advice this morning is to avoid ever saying, "Oh, you'll be okay." I think the sign goes up at that point, "I cannot think about your problem." The common lesson from experiences, if you are ever stuck in a moment when offering a response, always show empathy and never return hate for hate. That is a great Unitarian Universalist moral precept, but it is also the wisest piece of psychological advice ever handed down. So like the Quaker, and like Shirley Chisholm, and like Reverend Sally Beth at the gun rally, take control of your own personality, because your response truly matters. Thank you.